Hi guys, it's Dr. Sadaf, and I would love for you to like and share this podcast and make sure you leave me a review. I'd love those 5 stars. So please, when you send me a review, please make sure to put the 5 stars in and to share the episode with somebody that you know that could really use it. And I would absolutely appreciate it. Also, if you're looking to schedule an appointment with me, make sure you go to my email and put your name on the email list. You will be the first to know when I open up my office in spring of 2024. It's drsadaf.com. And last but definitely not the least, September 16th to the 23rd, 2024, I will be hosting a retreat with Dr. Basma Ferris in Morocco. You will be getting yoga and coaching, and we'll be doing excursions and cooking and spa and hammam and all of that great stuff along with meditation. So make sure you don't miss out. Spots are limited. So go to the link in my bio in both Instagram and TikTok to make sure you register. Enjoy the show. I am an American board certified OBGYN, a mom, a Muslim, and I'm talking about sex. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast. Welcome to the Muslim Sex Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sadaf Lodi, and this episode is everything you need to know about female genital mutilation and life thereafter and whether or not women can experience orgasm. But before I get into it, I want to make a few things very clear. And one is that I'm not giving any type of medical advice. So if you have any questions about your health, please speak with your friendly neighborhood healthcare provider. And if you have any questions about your religion, please speak with your friendly neighborhood religious leader. This is the Muslim Sex Podcast because I just happen to be a Muslim woman that talks about sex. So today I am very excited and so happy that Dr. Maria Oloko has said yes to coming on to the podcast again. She was on once last year, and today she is on again. So welcome, Dr. Oloko.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for having me again.
Yes, of course. We love you. So for those that may not remember or perhaps didn't see the last episode, maybe you could introduce yourself and let people know who you are and what you do, and then we can get into the topic.
Yeah. So my name is Dr. Maria Oloko. I am a urologist that specializes in comprehensive sexual health, reconstruction, and prosthesis, which means that I take care of the medical and surgical management of all sexual dysfunction in all genders. I'm also a international award-winning translational researcher, which is wild to me still, with a focus in defining vulvar anatomy and physiology. Our most notable work to date was defining how many nerves are in the human clitoris, which came out in 2023. And I'm a huge patient advocate and also the CEO and founder of Vulva AI, which helps people with chronic recurrent UTIs, chronic pelvic pain, vulvovaginal pain, recurrent vaginal infections, interstitial cystitis, and overactive bladder symptoms get cheaper, faster, more accurate diagnosis utilizing AI. So in order to better advocate for themselves in the doctor's office.
Amazing. Love it. So let's start and get into our topic for today. So just for people that may not know what female genital mutilation or, you know, female cutting is, perhaps you can just go over that a little bit and just let our viewers and our listeners know exactly what that is. And the reason why I'm dedicating a whole podcast to this is because I've had women ask me in the past, perhaps some women actually were women that have had this done to them when they were much younger and didn't have a say in it. And, you know, were always curious as to whether or not they could also experience pleasure. So
yeah,
love to get into
I mean, this is definitely a heavy topic for many people. And I think a lot of it stems from the fact that it is associated. There's a lot of cultural responsibility in FGM, right? So what female genital mutilation is something that happens all over the world, predominantly in sub-Saharan African countries, South Asian countries, and also in the Middle East. To date, there have been 200 million young girls that have experienced that. And I believe the statistic is that 3 million a year, every year will have 3 million more. So what it is oftentimes a cultural practice where they essentially make physical alterations to the external female genitalia. And that can have various degrees of manipulation, various degrees of mutilation, with the idea that this is a rite of passage. This is protecting your purity, your sexual being, you know, and taking away women's sexuality so that they can be more pure, more pure, more present, taking away their sexual pleasure and taking away their ownership of their sexuality.
So, you know, just for those people that may not know, so we're talking about removing the clitoris, right? And then different degrees of that in terms of is like some removal of the labia too, is that correct? And yeah. Maybe you could go over that a little bit.
Yeah, so the extent of female genital mutilation can range. There's type 1, type 2, type 3, and type 4. Type 1 is any sort of modifications or removal of the clitoris or the glands of the clitoris or the clitoral prepuce. The type 2 is removal or closure of the labia minora and the clitoris complex as well. And then type 3 is the more... is the most aggressive, that is not only removal of those structures, but then also closure of the vaginal canal. And then type 4 is any sort of other harmful procedures, which can be from piercing, cutting, burning of the vulva. So type 3, which is infibulation, is the most aggressive one. And that's the one where, you know, actually literally not only takes away and strips away from pleasure, but also makes things like childbirth and then sex actually much more difficult because when you're closing the hole where sex happens and babies come out of you, actually a lot of these women will then, when they are of childbearing age sexual maturation age, they will then have to get it actually opened up and incised to then have sexual intercourse or to then be able to deliver a baby.
Absolutely. So I actually had a patient that came one time. I was on call and she came in, she was laboring. And I took a look at her vulva because obviously, you know, I have to check her. I have to see how far along she is, what she's dilated to. And it looked so strange. And I just couldn't even, like the anatomy, you know, it's just... poor thing had everything sewn up. The labia was removed, like everything, you know, she just had a tiny, and it was the tiniest hole. And yeah. Can you imagine like a baby that's like 6-7 pounds coming out of that tiny little hole. And, you know, I asked her, I said, have you had anything done to your vulva region? And she said, I think she was ashamed and embarrassed. And she said, no, I haven't had anything. And I said, okay, that's fine. And then when she ended up delivering, you know, literally everything was filleted open. I mean, that's a little bit graphic, but it was. And, you know, I just felt so bad for her because I'm sure it was very painful and she didn't have time. She went so quickly in labor and she didn't have time to get an epidural. And so anyways, when it was time for me to sew everything up, you know, and this is why it's so important to have that type of communication with your patient. I actually, you know, just assumed that she wanted everything put back the way it was. And right as I began to sew, her husband was talking to her in a different language. And then he said to me, he said, please, you know, she wants it the way it's supposed to be, not the way that it was. And
oh, wow.
And I was so grateful that he told me that because I said, you know, yes, I should have asked you before, you know, I should have asked the patient before how she wanted it, but instead of just assuming that she wanted it the way that it was. And she just really wanted it fixed, you know, her vulva to appear the way that she thought, you know, normal should look like.
And yeah.
Really important.
And I think that speaks to kind of why female genital mutilation is so, you know, looked down upon, right? It's not, it has no medical varying, no medical acumen. It doesn't benefit or serve the person. And, you know, a lot of it is just rooted in culture and the cultural stigma of womanhood and female sexuality. So, you know, your patient wanting to essentially go back to normal is so telling of the fact that she was made this way, not because she wanted to, and I think that's the issue, is that there's a lot of coercion. There's a lot of either coercion, force, or cultural responsibility that's not necessarily at serving the best for the individual, because female genital mutilation is associated with significant morbidity and even mortality. And so, you know, another name for it is that's been called is female circumcision. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with penile circumcision, you know, there actually have been health benefits. And yes, there's definitely, some will argue, the argument about bodily autonomy, right? Of like, you're having body modification happening to you before you are able to consent. And also, though, we do see that there are health benefits from circumcision. However, with female genital mutilation, there are literally no health benefits from it. For these patients, they oftentimes are associated with the side effects of constant pain, pain with sex, repeated infections, which can then lead to infertility, bleeding, recurrent painful cysts and abscesses, issues with urination, because essentially if you're closing up the vulva, you're closing up the urethra too. And so they have issues with voiding and infections that come from that. Also, if you're closing up the vaginal canal, if they're menstruating, where's the blood going? And so that actually can lead to further complications and serious infections, you know? And also it's traumatic. It's the psychological effects of the ceremony itself are really, you know, really, really devastating. And so to then carry that on and to then associate anything that has to do with your genitals with that type of trauma, it's just a self-perpetuating harm over and over again for these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you bring up the psychological component of it, right? I mean, just to have something like that performed, especially when you're younger, and then not to know the difference until you get older. And then you start to wonder, you know, is there something wrong with you? Are you broken? Are you not supposed to be this way? You know, there's so many things that are attached to that. I'm so glad also that you bring up the fact that it is cultural. You know, a lot of times people tend to associate female circumcision with Muslims and Islam. And you know, I want people to know that that is not the case. You know, Islam does not mandate women to be circumcised. And so a lot of it is cultural. And most of it tends to happen to young girls when they are not able to advocate for themselves, right? They're so young. And I know that there's a whole movement that has been started against female circumcision and female genital mutilation. But, you know, a lot of times when these girls get older, they hold a lot of resentment and anger toward the individuals that did this to them, right? Because they're just so upset of what happened to their anatomy, and rightly so. I can, you know, can't even imagine.
Yeah, no, it is wild. It is so painful to hear the stories. Because on one hand, there is definitely, it's almost seen as a rite of passage for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And also the effects of that rite of passage, right? Just because something is just because it has cultural significance does not necessarily always make it right. And it comes to the idea of that many of these people experiencing this are experiencing this when they're so young. Oftentimes this is happening to them before the age of 15. And they don't really necessarily have a choice in the matter. And that's really the lack of choice, the lack of ability to make decisions about your own body that are actually not really even serving you, right? There's no health benefit that's ever been associated with female genital mutilation. And so it's going to take a lot of education around this, a lot of destigmatization around female sexuality, which is a problem that we have around the world, right? Even in America, we are not, you know, we don't have really great views on female sexuality. So it's another degree of policing of female sexuality to a point in the Western world where we're like, whoa, that's too intense, but it's all along the same spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, where we have lawmakers deciding what to do with our bodies, right? Whether or not women can have abortions and they become reproductive refugees going from state to state, you know,
yes,
to find health care for their pregnancy that's either unwanted or even their ectopic pregnancy that could kill them, right? If it,
yes.
And having to really force women to seek out their own health care, and then their practitioners getting jailed or, you know, fined for performing those services. I mean, it's really just absolutely ridiculous.
It's wild. It's wild. Right? Yeah, it's wild. So that's also something I always like to, you know, we cannot cast. We can't throw stones in glass houses or something like that. Like, we also have to just understand that this is a very extreme degree of control over women's bodies and female sexuality. But it's happening across the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'd love for us to delve into, you know, like I said, I do get patients or, you know, people that have had this happen to them and are curious as to whether or not they can experience pleasure after something like this has happened to them. And, you know, I absolutely know that they can experience pleasure, and I'd love to hear what you also think.
Yeah, no, it's definitely yes and. Yes, to the point, to the extent of how extreme or how invasive the female genital mutilation was. And because there are certain degrees of the cutting that actually preserves still some, like a lot of intact structures, right? When we think about orgasm is a really complex thing. There's no special orgasm button. I wish there was, that'd be awesome.
I know.
There would be, that would be awesome. So that actually, there's a, like, to me, orgasm is a symphony of many, many parts. And so depending on the degree of female genital mutilation, you can still have some parts of that symphony in order to get to an orgasm. So yes, it is definitely possible. And that factors into, you know, overall sense of belief of your body, right? If you tend to have really negative side, like tend to have really negative feelings around sexuality, your own body, it's going to be much harder, right? So there's a psychological component that definitely goes into it. And really, really working through that, I think, is one of the first steps to orgasm. And anyone is working through what society has made you feel ashamed about in your own body. And for these women, it's the physical, like it's not only just the internalized things that have been said, but it's a physical damage that has also happened to them. So physically, yes, depending on the degree of cutting, there is definitely hope and options to achieve orgasm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'll say that the first time I ever heard that the brain is the biggest sexual organ was from you at the ACOOG conference back in, I don't know if it was 2021 or 2022. And I was like, oh my God, yes, that's right. The brain is the biggest sexual organ. And so absolutely, right? I'm sure there's so much shame and stigma and fear and anger and perhaps even guilt having accompanied FGM that, you know, women do need to work through all of those emotions. And I would think that at that point, perhaps a sex therapist or even a sex coach could help patients navigate through those feelings and those emotions to, you know, if not go from sex negative to at least sex neutral.
Yes.
And then eventually go to perhaps sex positive. But I think it's a big leap to go from sex negative to sex positive.
Yes.
I think you have to achieve that middle ground first. So I think
absolutely.
That's really important.
I think that is Yes, 100%. And there's also just from even, yes, the brain is the biggest sex organ that you have. If you're, I always say I can optimize all of your parts. And if your head is not in it, like no matter what, we cannot get you to orgasm. And really, I like to think about orgasm as a treat, right? It is not the end all destination. The destination is pleasure. We're on a pleasure roller coaster. And at some point we may end up at orgasm and some point we may not. And that's also a huge thing of taking a lot of pressure off of yourself. So like one, learning how to love your body and learning and unpacking all of the cultural shame around your body. Like literally your genitals were so shamed that they cut it and they changed it. They physically made altercations to your body without your consent. Like what messaging does that send to these girls, right? And these women, and as they grow up into their bodies and their sexuality. So coming to net neutral, I love that, neutrality versus positivity, because one day the goal will be to get to positivity, but getting to neutral is also a huge feat.
Yeah,
when you come from cultures that have shamed sexuality. And then also taking orgasm out of the equation, mm-hmm. Because that also forces a lot of pressure now too. Yes. And you kind of forget that, yeah, there's a lot of fun that can happen between the start and orgasm. There's a lot of fun that can happen in there and relishing in that. And I feel like once people let go of needing to get to orgasm, they actually get there sooner and quicker and faster and easier. And then also the physiologics and a lot of the anatomical changes can cause a lot of pain with sex, right? So, you know, addressing those issues as well can ultimately then long-term lead to a really healthy, robust sex life. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And it's work that, you know, from a quality of life standpoint, I think is great, but also not only that, like, you know, sexual health is a great marker of health. And it's also with FGM can affect your urinary health too. So there's definitely even from a physiologic, you know, physical standpoint as to why seeking care for this and seeing what are different options for reversal may also overall help your urinary health, especially if you're suffering from recurrent infections.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I would also think that for somebody that has had FGM performed on them, they would just what you were saying with this pain with intercourse, that they would also probably have some type of vaginismus, right? So they probably they anticipate the pain, they anticipate the fear of anything penetrating. And so their muscles probably in the pelvic region also, you know, tense up and tighten up, and it probably shows up all in their body. And so you have to unpack all of that. So not only do they have FGM, but it's probably some component of vaginismus along with that, which
impacts absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and it's also understanding like culturally, you know, what is important to them, right? Yeah. I think that's always the lens that I want to take, because sometimes growing up in, I'm Nigerian, but I grew up in the Western society, mm-hmm. and there's like definitely some big cultural differences, and always wanting to be very cognizant of what they want. Because I think we, in the Western world, we, you know, female sexuality, female power, all of those things may not culturally be what they want for themselves, right? It may just be like, I just want to not have pain, or I just want to not have recurrent infections. And so meeting your patient where they're at too, and not necessarily enforcing our ideas of what sex should be, is also really important. And I think as we center the patient's experience always.
Absolutely. And, you know, they may just even want to consummate their marriage, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that could be, you know, a goal that they have. I think that's something, I don't know if you're familiar with Sensate Focus. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, I think that Sensate Focus is fantastic for those individuals that may have experienced trauma or abuse or something such as we could even use this for FGM, right? And so for those people that are not aware of what Sensate Focus is, it's a modality used in sex therapy where you focus on the sensations of touch. And really, yes, it's for your own experience. It's for your own pleasure. It's not for your partner. And really, having penile vaginal intercourse is really not even on the table. And same thing, like, yes, orgasm is not part of it. It's just it's a form of experiencing touch and really just being mindful when you're, yes, touching another person's body. It could even start with your own body.
Yes.
And then progress to, you know, touching somebody else's body and just really just experiencing the touch, the texture, the pressure, and even going as far as like the other senses, like the taste, the smell, all of that, and using all of your senses to really experience the moment.
Yes, yes. It's that beautiful symphony of what sex and sexuality can be. It's really just presence. Wow. And being present in the moment. And, you know, I think this is actually such a cool shift of, you know, what happens when your genitals, quote unquote, are not the healthiest, they've been changed, they've been modified in some way. You can still get to sexual pleasure, yes, without, you know, without the genitals, right? They're like the cheat codes to pleasure, but there's also pleasure throughout the body and figuring out what works for you and what works for your body, and centering that plus incorporating that with the patient's goals is so magical. It's so beautiful to be able to offer more than just genital reconstruction, right? There's like, cause you can change depending on the degree of mutilation that has happened and alterations that has happened. You can definitely 100%, you know, restore things pending. But if they're then still not fully in tune with themselves, they're still carrying a lot of shame, harboring guilt, pain, all the things, we're still not going to get them to sexual pleasure. And it is sexual pleasure comes from first knowing thyself, being comfortable with thyself, and, you know, being able to ask for what you want. And that takes a lot of work.
Absolutely. I think a lot of this also has to do with education, right? Education about, yes, your anatomy, education about just kind of your feelings and exploring that and just realizing what is possible for you. And how you, yes, and I love how you differentiated between, you know, a person having an orgasm and a person just experiencing pleasure, right? And that,
yeah,
you know, Emily Nagoski always says pleasure is the measure. And so it's not necessarily just focusing on, you know, orgasm, but it's just, are you enjoying what's happening? And, you know, you talked a lot about mindfulness as well. And In 2013, Rosemary Bassin, who came up with the circular model of the female sexual response, mm-hmm, she also did a study on a group of women and looked at whether or not mindfulness helped with libido. And of course, you know, you can probably guess what the results were, is that she noted that in these 90-minute sessions of like group therapy, the women that participated in a 6-month follow-up, they increased mindfulness increased lubrication, it increased arousal, increased libido, and it helped with overall sexual satisfaction in these women. So definitely just being present in the moment will help with almost everything.
Yeah, yes, yes. And this is such a, I think it absolutely speaks to when people have gone through trauma like this, right? Because, you know, it's called mutilation for a reason, right? It's not often, it's oftentimes not performed in really therapeutic spaces, right? So there's a lot of trauma just even behind that. And so when you're dealing with taking and having the privilege to take care of these patients, right, it's understanding and coming from a trauma-informed place and always centering their experience and always educating them about these things. So many people, if they're coming, they don't even know why it happened to them. They just know that this is just a rite of passage. I'm supposed to do this. And they don't even fully experience there's no informed consent essentially behind this procedure. And so to then even start, you know, saying like, hey, this is what could be normal for you, and just educating them behind that can also help them empower them and say like, wait a second, that wasn't right. I deserved better. And then it's a lot of, it's a cycle of education, re-education, and always centering their needs and wants, because it might evolve, right? As they're learning more about, you know, what happened to them, why it happened, kind of the phenomenon behind why it happened, it might definitely change their overall stance on what they want and their ultimate goals, right? Which is kind of this really, like a really empowering thing for them. Is like they had their choice stripped away, and now we're able to give it back to them and give them choice by education and centering their goals.
Right. Absolutely. I think that's so important, as making this patient, you know, having this discussion with your patient and putting their goals first. And I think just, you know, what you had said before is that not using our Western lens, you know, both you and I come from, you know, different countries, and the cultural norms in those countries may be something different, and what those women want can be totally different than what we growing, you know, having grown up here in the West want. And so I think that's really important how you say to, you know, make sure that you center the patient and always talk to them and see what it is that they want and how they want to move forward once that they've, you know, gotten the education that they want and what they needed. And also if they had to have surgery to fix whatever it is that they wanted to fix, right? So perhaps some patients are okay with what their anatomy looks like now, and other times they're not. And just like what you said, you know, it can lead to recurrent bladder infections, urinary tract infections when you're not able to urinate properly through the urethra. And then also what you mentioned is, where does the blood go when you menstruate, right? I mean, it's probably just collects there. And so, you know, you'd probably need something so that blood could be released outside. So those really important topics, I think.
Once you address the, you know, physical, like the ailments, right, of the recurrent UTIs, the recurrent vaginal infections, you know, the disease states, and then I start thinking about quality of life, and you can you can combine those in those discussions that you're having with them of like, hey, listen, we're gonna have to open this up so that you're not getting UTIs again. And also sexually, this is what could happen. Like, what are, from your standpoint, what do you want? What do you need? How can we help you get to your goals? Because definitely we don't want you to be having UTIs. And I'm pretty sure you also don't want to be having UTIs. So that's definitely an incentive to do something. And also you could be having, you know, some pleasure. Is that something that you're interested in? And because a lot of these women have been oppressed in, like, female sexuality just oppressed in these countries that are happening. And so it might be that, like, being a fully embodied sexual woman might even be terrifying to them. And they're not quite there yet, or they might never, ever get there. And so it's just, I always say that, I always want us to take these conversations from a culturally relevant standpoint. And because it's not something, it definitely happens in Nigerian culture, but it's not something that I was ever subjected to. So I just always ask people of, what do you want? And then let's get you there. And we'll go from there. And I think that's an approach I take. And I think we all take this approach when we deal with sexual health. It's just figuring out there's no normal, and figuring out what is a good normal for that person. And the only person that can tell us is them, because we're not in their bedrooms.
That's right.
We don't want to be.
No, definitely not. But, you know, I agree with you 100%. I think that, you know, so many patients and people that perhaps follow you on your social media. And I know those that some people that follow me on my social media, right, are in countries where they're not able to really fully express their sexuality, or, you know, feel that they don't have enough knowledge, right? So that's why they're on the platform, so that they can understand and learn, because they may not be getting that in the countries that they're in. So I think that what, you know, you and I do, I think is really important, not only just for us here in the United States, but also globally, because a lot of women specifically don't have access to information. And or, I would even say that here in the United States, when we talk about sexual education, right, it really depends on the zip code that you're in and what the politics are in, just even in your town board, right? And what they allow and what they don't allow. And a lot of sex education is based on fear. It's based on fear of sexually transmitted infections and of pregnancy and also of abstinence. And so we never hear about consent. We don't hear about pleasure. We don't hear about, you know, just learning your own anatomy. I think that so many women will come to me and they'll be surprised that they have three holes, right? That they have a urethra, a vagina, and a rectum. And they think that, you know, the same hole that they urinate from is also the same hole where their, you know, baby comes out of. And there's so much work, even just right here in the U.S. that we have to do.
Yes. I think the more, I feel like, to me, knowledge is so empowering. I grew up in a very, like, I thought it was just Nigerian culture. So actually, you taught me something when we met. So I grew up with very, like, strict parents, very, like, very deeply religious. Sexuality was totally shamed, no matter, like, female sexuality, men can do whatever. But female sexuality, absolutely shamed. And I just always assumed that that was Nigerian culture, very, like, very puritanical, da 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 da. And then I met you and you're like, no, there's like, there are whole books about African sexuality and like all the things. And I was like, blew my mind that it's a whole nother level of like, I'm pretty sex positive. I'm, you know, it's my line of work. But even just learning that is actually deeply ingrained in my culture, even though my parents told me it wasn't. You know, it was such a like total game changer for me. So knowledge is power. Like the more that you learn about sexuality, your own body, it definitely shapes your ideas and beliefs. And for me, it's been empowering. And hopefully, you know, that's why I think we spend so much time educating. And it's the work that we love to do, is because, you know, to truly shape someone's understanding of who they could be and who they are and who they want to be is so cool, just with giving them a couple of facts. And it just changes their entire life. Like, you gave me that little tidbit and I was like, leveled up.
Absolutely. You know, it's and shout out to Habiba Kande. That's right. He's with his Women of Desire and Kunyaza. And, you know, he did a whole thing on the orgasm gap through the BBC. And so he's done a lot of research and scholarly work on it. But anyways, I think that it's been so informative and so enlightening. And I think that, you know, a lot of the reasons why I do what I do is to empower and to educate. And I'm sure that that's perhaps why you probably do something similar, right? Is to empower and to educate women all over the world so that they can have the sexual agency and then advocate for themselves. So I think that that's so important.
Exactly. And I think a lot of this work is, you know, I love, I'm actually very anti-tradition. I think tradition is a great way to control people. There's like really beautiful and amazing traditions, but then a lot, like the way that I was raised, a lot of tradition, cultural tradition, I just didn't understand it. I was like, this isn't benefiting, literally, if it's not benefiting me, I don't want to be a part of it. Yeah. And like, this is, I think, a great way, or a lot of campaigns around FGM is education, right? It's understanding and like teaching the moms why they should not subject their daughters to this, right? You know, it's breaking that generational curse and those generational cycles of, you know, why are we doing this? Cultural reasons. Well, what's the cultural reason? Oh, it's because of actually, like, there's no actual benefit. You know, like, getting people to understand and breaking these cultural traditions, these traditions that aren't serving people. Because if it was serving people and there was, like, actual significance to it, from a medical standpoint, yes, there's lots of significance from a cultural standpoint, but also start asking the questions of, why is there significance? You know, I like coming, growing up the way I was raised, I just always started questioning traditions that didn't make sense, that like were directly harming myself or others, or like, why are we doing this? What's the point of this? And so that's how I was raised. That's how I grew up. I was not raised that way, but I grew up that way, much to my parents' chagrin. But it's educating, this is going to be the way to stop this is to start educating the women behind these, like to empower them to say, this is my body, my choice. And now that I have all the information around this, I can now make an informed decision, whether it's to proceed or whether it's not, you know, that's their decision. But right. As long as they're understanding why they're making the decisions, the choices behind them, and hopefully it leads to a more empowered decision from their standpoint. And I think that's really what the root cause of, like, the root issue of this is the disempowerment of choice, the inability of choice.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Well, this has been such a fantastic conversation, and I so appreciate your time and your expertise and your knowledge. You're totally amazing. For all those people that are listening and watching and wondering, like, God, she is so good. How can I follow her? How can I make an appointment? And I know you started a new venture, which is called MUMD. Is that right?
Yeah. So MUMD Consulting. Yes, MUMD Consulting. That is, as I'm building my startup, I am doing consulting work on the side. I have a 6-month menopause program that's concierge, all like everything that you could potentially ever want to know about menopause, from sexual health, skin health, hair health, heart health, brain health, vaginal, sexual health. We go through it in the 6-month boot camp. We get you on the right hormones, we get you on the right regimen, so that you can thrive. And then I also have a, sexual health consulting advocacy, service for people that are in California. I can actually see them and prescribe, but if you're out of the state of California, if you have issues with chronic vaginal pain, recurrent UTIs, just getting a second opinion on and ways to think outside of the box. You know, as a vulvar researcher, I've realized that a lot of these conditions are related to vulvar health and how to, like, things like recurrent UTIs, recurrent vaginal pain, recurrent, you know, chronic vulvovaginal pain, these are all related to your vulvar health. And so I come up with a way for you to get diagnosed and get treatment and actually work with your doctor that you have already so that you can actually get diagnosed, because many doctors don't know how to do this work. So that's all the service too.
That is amazing. And what's your handle on Instagram?
Yes. So my Instagram handle is Maria Yuloko MD. And then I'm also at vulvaai.co is my other Instagram company. So everyone, if you're interested in getting personalized information on anything vulva related, vaginal, sexual health, all the things, that is a great place to get that information. So follow along. Join the mailing list. We're going to be launching this year, and we'd love to have you join the Vulvar Revolution.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate having you on. So thank you.
Thank you.
And it's been real and really intimate. And so we are done here. And remember, this is not meant to be any type of medical advice. So if you have any questions about your health, please go speak with your friendly neighborhood healthcare provider. And until next time, this is the Muslim Sex Podcast. So thank you for listening to the podcast, and make sure you leave us a review, share and like the podcast. And if you leave me a review, I'd love to shout you out on social media. So be sure that you share it with all your friends. And thanks for listening.